management at the New York State DEC. And I am the chair of the Waste Advisory Panel, which is part of the team advising the Climate Action Council on recommendations and policies to achieve significant methane and greenhouse gas emissions across New York State as part of the CLCPA. So welcome to the sixth meeting of the Waste Panel. Welcome to the panelists. Thank you all for joining on a nice snowy day, at least here in Albany. And thank you to all of you signed on as attendees. We appreciate your attendance and your interest. Today for our meeting, we're going to spend the first hour here from 2 till 3 catching up with the subgroups and discussing issues and concerns that the panelists may have as we continue to move forward and develop recommendations to meet the ambitious methane emission goals that we've set. The latter part of the meeting from 3 to 4 is going to be a public input session. People have been signing on to make brief remarks, provide comments and direction to the panel, and we really look forward to hearing some of the public comments and concerns as we go forward. It's going to be a big important part of this entire process to get public input and make sure we're capturing all the concerns and issues that are out there concerning waste and our work here. We'll talk a little bit more about format when we get to that point, but essentially this is a little bit of a listening session for the panel, so it's the people that have signed on can speak for 2 minutes or so and provide some ideas and recommendations that they have. We'll do a quick acknowledgement, but it's not going to be a full, Q&A back and forth. We'll certainly capture all your comments and factor them into our considerations moving forward, so we look forward to that session later on. I'll make a few introductory comments and do some housekeeping here. So again, this is the sixth Waste Panel meeting. We've been working steadily since the panel was formed in November, and we established a number of sub-panels and sub-groups to look at various categories of the waste management infrastructure in New York State, and all those groups have been working very diligently. They've been scheduled a lot of meetings and had a lot of good productive discussions, as well as kind of cross sub-panel and in some cases with other panels that are part of the Climate Action Council. And we've been generating a lot of good ideas and fleshing those out as we go. Obviously, the goal here is to focus on strategies and policies to reduce methane and greenhouse gas emissions. So that is our primary core. So those policies and strategies can run a range of possibilities, whether it's from statutory regulatory changes all the way up to financial incentives and other programs like that. So there's been a lot of good work going on since we started, and we're really getting into the phase now of refining those recommendations. There's always room for new ones. That's why we're interested in the public input today. But certainly as we go forward, encourage the panelists and the sub-panels to really hone in on the details and refinement of those recommendations. Our goal here really is by mid-March to have a good draft set of recommendations that we can then further refine. So that is our goal, which it's already the second week of February, so we got about 4 or 5 weeks really to put that together. Obviously, the staff working groups comprised of staff from DEC and other agencies like NYSERDA, DOT, and a number of others are there to support the work of the panel as they have been. And they will be taking your recommendations and really working them up into a final form here over the next few weeks. There's a number of information that we've shared with the panel here over the last couple of weeks. We recently posted to the SharePoint, and it's up on the webpage, a series of just transition principles, which are sort of guiding principles as we move forward to make sure we incorporate climate justice, just transition, environmental justice concerns into our policies, subject to the provisions of the CLCPA. So I encourage every panelist to get familiar with those principles and start factoring those guidelines into your work as we prepare our recommendations. Our next meeting is February 22nd. And that meeting, we're going to spend a large amount of time talking about those just transition principles and equity considerations and how they can be factored into our recommendations. So we'll be providing you with an agenda ahead of time and some structure to that meeting so we can have a good productive conversation on some of those equity considerations. So that's the focus for the next meeting. I don't believe we have anything on the calendar after that, but we will probably work to put a meeting on in early March to further refine our draft recommendations, and then perhaps one later in March just to do any follow-up tweaks and adjustments that need to be made. And of course, the overall schedule is for the formal recommendations to be sent to the Climate Action Council in April. There's other information that we've also shared on the webpage. One of our fellow panels under the Climate Action Council, the Land Use and Local Government panel, did a survey for the public to express areas of interest and concern and issues that should be raised in their work. And a number of those comments were very relevant to the waste panel. So we've shared those with you. I suspect we'll hear some of those similar concerns today when we get in the public a portion of the program today. And we've also shared with you a template for our recommendations, so you should be working with the staff work group as you go forward to populate those templates for the recommendations. So those are all on the SharePoint as well. So for the next 45 minutes, what I'd like to do really is just to get an update from each of the sub-panels. Just be a verbal update to talk about what you've been discussing since the last panel meeting, where you are with some of your recommendations, and then identify if you have any needs or additional work that need to be done on those. You can raise those issues, and then if you'd spend about 10 minutes for each panel, that would be great, and we have a couple minutes there at the end to kind of wrap up. And then right at 3 o'clock, I want to move into the public portion of the program. Does that sound good to everyone? A few nods, great. Sally Rowland, who heads our work group, did I leave anything out? Or is there anything that you want to add for the benefit of the larger group?
Nope, sounds like you covered it all.
All right, great, thank you. So who would like to volunteer present their panel updates first? Jane, thank you.
Okay. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I guess maybe I should have volunteered to go first because we actually have not met since the last sub-panel meeting that we had a couple of weeks ago. But we have been working on, we got the new format from Molly and Sally. And so we've been trying to integrate the mitigation strategies that we had already identified into the new format, and that kind of gets us thinking about kind of how to flesh out some of the ideas. So just to kind of review, some of our, the kind of overarching goal that we see is transforming wastewater treatment into wastewater resource recovery, kind of supporting that transformation. And there's certain things that are really more specific in that, mitigating fugitive emissions. We had ideas to convert septic systems to some more centralized systems where it's appropriate, density, population density-wise. Also repairing leaks and flares at existing facilities where there might be fugitive emissions of methane. And then also expanding or improving anaerobic digestion, at other facilities, across the state. And then a large piece of this kind of transition to resource recovery has to do with organics management. And so we did meet with kind of a lot of other members of this panel in this past week to talk about, you know, organics diversion. And so our piece of that is, you know, organics diversion of biosolids, so taking biosolids out of landfills. And that's something that, you know, I personally have worked a lot on, and there are a lot of significant greenhouse gas emissions reductions that would result from that. And then kind of part and parcel of the organics diversion from landfills is recycling the nitrogen and phosphorus content of our biosolids to assist in plant growth. And so it's kind of, so, you know, not only kind of getting the methane containing material out of the landfills, but also, you know, kind of moving it over and recycling the nutrients, so that less sustainable ways of getting those nutrients are realized, are eliminated, and so that we're able to kind of keep those cycles consistent in a sustainable way. And then lastly is to provide an outlet to recycle other organic streams, such as food waste, to generate energy and also reduce the volumes of the material that needs to be disposed. So there's kind of a larger discussion, I'm sure that's going to come up today, about organics management, and so we want to be an active part of that overall strategy. And that's it. I think you may be muted.
Thank you. We've got a little time left for your segment. Is there, what needs and issues do you see moving forward here in the next couple of weeks in order to continue to refine your recommendation?
I think that, you know, we've been trying to kind of nail down what the actual greenhouse gas emissions reductions would be from each one of the mitigation strategies. And we've been trying to put some numbers on that. I think that we'll need to coordinate a little bit more with the Jen Hagel group in order to understand what's in the current inventory, to see if we can pull out numbers and make estimates from that. I think that would be really helpful. And then I think the continuation of the discussion on overall organics management, and something that we had spoken about in the last panel meeting, was about conducting a market assessment, a market study to, you know, as we're diverting so many organics from landfills, like not just biosolids, but, you know, food waste and other organic streams, you know, we need places for these things to go, right? And so we can't just kind of create products without having somewhere to go. So having a market assessment, figuring out where the needs are, and trying to then figure out, you know, well, with these raw materials that we currently have going to landfills and these needs that we have in the market, how do we put these two together? And so I actually think that something that we haven't fully formed, and I think it's going to kind of take the whole panel to work out, but how to put those pieces together to kind of make one kind of holistic plan for the state.
So, Sally, I know your team has been looking at some of those emissions from the bio sector. Do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, we have been starting to work with Suzanne on that, on their looking at how, as Jane mentioned, how did they calculate the numbers for the inventory. So we have done some preliminary work on kind of plugging some numbers into the EPA models that came up the inventories based on. So we got a little ways to go. We haven't done wastewater yet, so I haven't done a lot of work in that, but a lot of it on the solid waste landfill side, as you can imagine, comes from how much you can divert and how much you can increase gas collection. It really drives the greenhouse gas emissions reductions, not surprisingly.
Okay. Any questions for Jane from the rest of the group? Okay. Thank you, Jane. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
All right. Who wants to go next? Risa, you tried to volunteer to go first, and Jane beat you, so.
Me to it. No, I'm glad Jane went first, because we also have not met as just the materials management group since the last meeting. We did, I think everyone in our group participated in the organics discussion that happened on Friday. Played a part in developing those recommendations. So that's been where our focus has been over the last couple weeks. I think our next big task is to take the recommendations in our plan and put them into the new format kind of work through the details as we go through that. And that's pretty much it. So I don't know if we want to go through the organics recommendations that were discussed, or I could pull that document out if you wanted me to cover that, Martin.
If you wanted to run through just kind of your bullets on some of the recommendations you're looking at.
Sure. We talked about expanding the legislative requirements around food scrap recovery and disposal bans. Talked about various different approaches to that. One would be to extend it down to smaller generators of 1 ton per week from the 2 ton per week level, and then eventually to residences. Another would be to do a straight disposal ban as opposed to the approach in the existing legislation. So we talked about a variety of those options. I guess we'll have to work through what the recommendation looks like as we refine that. Next, we talked about requiring planning units to develop food scrap recovery programs. This is sort of required initially, and we talked about some of the benefits and drawbacks of relying on planning units, but I think ultimately decided it was an important piece of the puzzle, even though it may not solve the entire problem. We also talked about methods to increase immediately residential access to composting by, for example, expanding the network of food scrap drop-off sites, thinking about things like farmers markets that are used broadly in New York City through the Grow NYC program and other potential drop-off locations as a way of getting people in the habit immediately while we're looking at developing broader capacity and infrastructure down the road. We talked a lot about different funding required for composting and organics recycling infrastructure, collection and processing, and what the needs for that are. And I think settled on a variety of sources, including municipal grants through the EPF or other sources, potentially a targeted strategic fund at ESD for private sector programs, and some incentives as well to provide a well-rounded set of opportunities there. I think this connects to what Jane mentioned, looking at a statewide study on organics, really mapping out the range of organic streams, what by generator, by type of material, what's the most appropriate technology to recover them, what incentives might help to do that. Understanding that a plan is not going to actually recover material, but it would help us to understand what the ground is and how much of what material is out there and what we can do with it, for example. In terms of market development, we talked about connecting this to the materials management recommendation on requiring the use of compost and digestate both in government agency projects and also by permit in private projects. Lastly, looking at funding for not-for-profit to step up donation of usable food, both to feeding humans and animals.
Okay, thank you. What do you think you need to be looking at, or what needs do you have? What support do you need over the next couple of weeks to kind of further refine these recommendations?
Well, I think there's a lot of folks involved in this and involved in that organics group, and I think it would be helpful to identify who the lead is. So we're clearly, assigning this out, unless the staff can sort of step up and coordinate on this effort. We did talk about a number of questions around sort of quantitative impacts and things like that, which I think we can kind of work through. But I think it would be good to clarify who the lead is to sort of take all this and get it in the new format and flesh out the details and sort of manage the process of the multiple, group heads and panel members that have an interest here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. Your group is also looking at some of the other enhancements either to the recycling programs or product stewardship.
Yeah,
do you want to talk a little bit about that?
There's certainly a logic to rolling this into our group's recommendations given the focus on expansion of different types of diversion programs that have similar focus. So in our group, our main recommendations are around policy, really focusing on extended producer responsibility, on infrastructure, focusing again on both public and private sector incentives and financing for investment, and then on market development, again, through purchasing permit requirements and other creative uses. So we can probably integrate a fair bit of this into that if you want to sort of place this squarely in our purview. I think there's a fair amount of overlap, although there is a little bit of a, there are some nuances, obviously. The disposal ban piece is, it's not unique to organics. It's certainly helpful in the recycling end of things, but it plays out a little bit differently on the organic side from a policy point of view.
So when you say organics ban, you're talking about a mandated source separation type policy similar to
right.
the statutory requirements for your traditional recyclables.
Right.
That's what you're talking about. Okay.
Right. And again, the group talked about a number of different pathways that could take. We need to narrow in on what's the pathway we're going to recommend and what's what are the expected greenhouse gas reductions from that pathway. Well, Sally or Molly wants to weigh in, or there are also a lot of other panel members on that call who may want to weigh in here.
This is Sally. I think it is a good summary. It is very important. When I look at trying to estimate emissions reductions, that question you have raised, would the proposal be that there is basically a ban on food scraps going to the landfill after a certain date and combustion? That to me lends to a higher estimate of emissions reductions versus an expansion of the existing law, which has a typically, there has to be a viable economic facility available, which to me would mean a lower estimate of emissions reduction. So when I go to try to crunch those numbers, it's going to be important which path you're choosing to go down on how that would be worked out.
Okay. So I think, Risa, on your point about, to make sure that we're efficiently reviewing these proposals, we'll take a look at where all each of the subpanels are at the staff level, and I think we'll parse out some assignments, so
okay.
Make sure you have some clarity moving forward here in the next couple of weeks on which groups should focus on which areas. Certainly encourage cross panelist collaboration and subgroup collaboration as we go forward. Yes, Steve.
Excuse me, if I might. The one issue that, again, depending on the policy pathway that's decided, and I think, Sally, we mentioned this about the sequencing of you know, the current law with the large quantity generators that gives you one pathway. If it's a ban and you work towards it, it's another. But I think the point that I just wanted to mention here was that that has to be sort of sequenced with, you know, the expected build out of capacity and the kind of capacity, whether it's composting or whether it's anaerobic digestion and or avoidance, you know, don't create the food waste in the first place, diverting it to animals and people. So those pathways of actually getting capacity built, there was a lot of debate about that. Do you incentivize it? And what is the goal of the objective? So, you know, we want to see those reductions, and we want the plan and we want the policy, but if there's no pathway, if we can't make the economic case to build the asset, the fulfillment of the plan's not going to happen. So there was some debate about how much that should be included in the recommendations. Is that fair? Do you agree? So, you know, and what do we incent and what don't we incent? So we're anxious as a regulated industry. There's capital available to build infrastructure, but we got to know the path. We got to have the design. So that was one point I thought was very important.
Yes, I agree. Okay. Any other questions for Risa?
Martin, I just have a question for you. I think one of the challenges we're going to face is that, not that we don't have enough recommendations, but that we have dozens and dozens of recommendations. And due to the sort of loose structure necessary for an advisory committee like this, it may be difficult to figure out where, you know, do we have some goal? Are we going to get our top 10 recommendations to the committee? Are we just going to give them several dozen recommendations? Do you have any thoughts on that? What role will DEC have in helping to shape that? Who defines that? And do you have any sense from the CLCPA advisory committee itself what they're expecting from us?
Well, certainly we've been trying not to limit any of you in your discussions. So we want to have, you know, as much on the table as we can, understanding that some of the recommendations, we won't have the data to support necessarily a good pathway analysis, as Steve noted. In some cases, it's going to be a little difficult to quantify the emissions reductions. We understand that. In other cases, we clear areas where we get the most methane reduction, you know, benefit from these policies. So obviously, the overall priority is to maximize methane and greenhouse gas emissions. So those things are going to take higher priority. So those sectors and areas that we can identify that have the highest potential to reduce emissions will go forward farther. There certainly is going to be a lot of discussion once we tee up our recommendations, you know, in the Climate Action Council itself. And then, as you know, as you saw at the last Climate Action Council, there's a rather rigorous, you know, integration analysis that's going to take place, you know, at the Climate Action Council level, taking all these recommendations and really looking through them for a variety of lenses and analyses. So certainly I would expect that recommendations will fall off that table as we go forward. But I think at this point, let's leave everything on the table that we can. But obviously, you know, look to Sally and others to provide you guidance as you're going forward. But obviously, we've got to spend the most attention and the most detail and refinement on the ones that have the highest emission reduction potential, certainly. I don't know if that answers your question, Eric, or not, but okay.
Martin, I just got a question in the chat about what we were recommending in terms of requirements for using compost and digestate in state projects. So this is a recommendation for compost, digestate, and other recycled materials, potentially glass, concrete, and other things. And the recommendation here is that we require the use of those items on state projects through state procurement efforts, and also require agencies to incorporate requirements into permits for large projects that can use those things. So if it's a construction project, if it's a private road project, office building, things like that, you could use compost in the landscaping, glass aggregate, you know, these other recycled materials in those products. So it's sort of taking the government procurement and then going one step further, requiring it also in permits for new building and construction.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to the next group. Lauren, can you give a little update on the landfill group?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And John, please jump in as the co-lead for organics and landfill subpanel. Our update is going to sound a lot like Reese's and Jane's, in that we haven't met as an individual subpanel since the last meeting, but we've been a part of the combined meetings on specific topics as well. And most of the subpanel was also on the organics discussion that we were all part of last week. And so that obviously is an important part of what we've been discussing. I think, you know, we've gotten a new template, and our next step is to take our recommendations as a subpanel and to put them into that new template and to flesh those out. And we've been focused very much on you know, organics diversion and management, as Risa talked about. And then also, how do we use best-in-class technologies, both for building out infrastructure, but also for the reduction of emissions at landfills and other waste management facilities? And then we've had a lot of discussion around incentives. And you know, that's a piece I think we need to really get some more detail on, and that's going to be somewhat cross panel, I think, as we take it the next step, because there's a mix of incentives, and some are financial and some are not financial, but really it's the mechanisms by which the infrastructure to support these recommendations comes to fruition. And so that's been a very core part of our discussion, and I don't think there's going to be universal agreement on which levers to pull in order to create a kind of incentives for infrastructure and development to solve all these initiatives. So I think that's a piece that we as a subpanel and we as part of the larger waste panel are going to need some guidance on in terms of how do we best lay those out. So our discussions have been very market development oriented, but that's not always the, you know, universally agreed upon within the group. So I think that's going to be one of the challenges that we face in trying to figure out what's the path that we think, and then we as a subpanel and we as a overarching waste advisory panel put forward. And we've had quite a wide range of discussion about that, and there's quite a number of interesting ideas to create incentives, again, financial and otherwise. So there's been some really creative and good discussion around it, but there hasn't been a real consensus building. So I think that's our our challenge.
Sure, and so, you know, I know many of you participated in this sort of cross-panel discussions we had a week or so ago about the bioeconomy and the role of biofuels and renewable natural gas and all that. So we will continue those discussions and help continue to provide you with guidance and clarity on that as we go forward. So I appreciate that. Anybody have any questions for Lauren? Lauren, is there any additional data that you need from the group? I know we've worked we're providing here a little bit of nuts and bolts information on, you know, sort of the state of landfill gas capture on landfills around the state, so we can share that with you in terms of like how many facilities have flares, how many have infrastructure in place for landfill gas to energy projects, those type of things. Is there any additional data that you think you need over the next couple of weeks that we can get to you?
Yeah, Yeah, no, I think that the landfill data would be helpful, and I think just having a sense of the size of the organics, organic waste in New York State overall, and where that waste is, what's the composition of that waste and where it's headed now.
Yeah, okay.
I think that
sure.
A piece of that will help us with the prioritization, right? We were talking about how do we take all these recommendations and which one has the biggest opportunity for reduction. And I think having more concrete data on organic waste in the state of New York, where it's going now, would help us to put together better or prioritize the recommendations with the objective of emissions reductions.
Okay, sure. Well, we can certainly help you with that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Something else that would be helpful too, Martin, would be any estimates that that the agency might have with regard to diversion of organics from the landfills in terms of how that might impact existing facilities. So the estimates in terms of diversion from existing facilities, that would be helpful as well. I think one of the other things too that Lauren, our group touched on, was co-location of facilities at the environmental landfills. How do we, you know, what do we do from a best practices standpoint in terms of co-location of additional facilities to further process materials coming to the facilities, and then establishment of, you know, performance standards at the waste facilities. You know, what are the mechanisms that we utilize from a methodology standpoint in terms of measurement? Obviously, we have the existing data that is collected by the EPA that all facilities are reporting, and you know, where does that overall mix of data being collected in terms of how we look at the actual impacts of facilities?
Okay, John. Sure, we'll see what we could do there.
Martin,
thank you.
Martin, this is George. I just want to tell you, I have to jump off. It's the opening NYWEA annual conference today, so this hit on a bad day. I better jump back into that conference.
All right. Thank you, George. Appreciate it. Okay. Let's go to Toke now to talk a little bit about the local scale and climate justice subgroup work. Toke, can you give us a brief update on
Yes, I can. Our update is similar to everyone else's in that we haven't met formally as our subgroup, but have had conversations, and some of us were on the broader organics call. But we are working as well to shape the recommendations into the format that was sent out. And some of the things that we're working on are big picture waste reduction and centralizing donations and ending and trying to curb the production of non-recyclable materials to begin with, based on understanding, you know, the materials of what sold or donated, and making sure that donations are getting to the right places in a centralized way. Talking about waste reuse, things like, you know, it's like mandating municipal collection of organics, expanding local scale composting and recycling in equitably distributed ways, including potential conversion of transfer stations into well-run just the composting or sorting or processing sites, assuming that we are reducing the amount of that waste that is being generated to begin with and that needs to, you know, be shipped further out. Talking about organics, some of this was on the call, the organics call, but talking about a plan for ending organics to landfills and incinerators, and talking about improving anaerobic digestion at wastewater treatment facilities, but not expanding it. Just talking about concerns with the expansion of biogas production, but understanding they're limited limited ways that, it could be beneficial. Just, we don't want to incentivize waste. Talking about waste transport mechanisms, electric vehicles and bicycles, and reliance on marine and rail transport for limited distant transport of materials, and then focusing on employment, well-paying, safe, green jobs, and waste management in public and private sectors, and specifically focusing on marginalized communities and in jobs for management, sustainable facility construction, composting, transport, etc. And then we're also talking about developing sustainable blueprints for grassroots organizations who have been impacted by systemic bias and racist policies. I don't know if Bridget, you want to talk a little bit more about this, but everything, you know, we're working to fit all the recommendations that we're making into the format that was provided.
So, thank you, Tok. So, we were talking a little bit at the kind of cross panel group there last week or so about, you know, some of the model groups and programs that you're familiar with, certainly in New York City area and other urban areas, and that Bridget has been working with. And I think one of the things that you could really spend a little time on is how those local programs can really be exported across the state, right? To find models that can be easily adapted in other densely populated areas of disadvantaged communities, those type of things, where those programs can be replicated. And I know there are a number of programs around the state, but it might be good to take a look at some of those successful models that you all have been really involved with, and coming up with some recommendations to really scale that up, if you will, across the state, and you know, I think you could really generate some a lot bigger numbers, you know, that get you higher up on that list, that priority that Eric was talking about, where you really start to impact the solid waste management structure in the state, but at a very local level. So I think that's maybe a charge to your group, is to really look at how those great local programs can be, you know, can be spread around the state in an impactful way. So we can, you know, again, I think some of the organics numbers that John and others were looking for can help you on that, so you can understand kind of what the universe is out there, and then start applying those models. So
yeah, I would say I agree with you. And sorry if I can
go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, from the folks that I talk with, they do wish that the municipalities that they live within were doing this work. Mm-hmm. And so maybe there's a way to fold in, you know, their work, but being funded by state and city governments, I just wanted to add that note.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the other thing too is you got to mobilize champions out there, right? I mean, that's always the key with sustainability programs and local programs, is that many of them are highly successful because you have a highly motivated champion in that particular community that really drives that effort. And the concern always is that you got to continue to generate champions. And I know you were talking a little bit about maybe some educational programs, training programs, job training, skills training, whatever the terminology you want to use. But they're really to continue to generate that next generation of champions, if you will, that can, you know, can pick up these local programs and really make them sustainable in the long run. Because I know my experience is we'll have a great program in a community, and then as soon as the driving force has to move on to something else, it often isn't that foundation that's been established. So I think that's a key to look at too, is to get that educational component, training component, you know, built into these programs. And I think that's the real key to keep them going. So, and local support as well, obviously. Local municipal support there, too.
Hi, Martin. It's Bridget.
Hi, Bridget.
Hi. Yeah, you expressed that many times about making sure that we can expand this, you know, across the state and in other local communities. And the thing about, you know, the particular my organization is that the program is expandable anywhere. You can just pick it up and take it anywhere. So my question is, I guess I need a little guidance when it comes to and saying that it's interchangeable. So how is that communicated to, how can I communicate it to say if I'm in Allegheny or anywhere else, how do I pinpoint particular regions, or can someone kind of like walk me through how I can just pick up the project, the initiative, and take it somewhere else? It's basically that kind of simple.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm not the expert in this, but we have folks in our staff that work with in state, and we can certainly get you speaking with you about that. But I think if you identify the factors to success in these programs, whether it's local support, whether it's a local rule that allows you to do composting in an area that maybe normally wasn't zoned for that, for example, or whether it's funding, whether it's training, you know, whether there's certain logistical things that are necessary, mm-hmm. Or frankly, whether there's enough, you know, material to work with and to make it worthwhile in a particular area. So I think the first step there is to identify those things that lead to success, and then see what's available in the rest of the state. And if some of those factors are missing in certain areas, that's where your recommendations come in to identify those needs and then ways to fill those needs. So I think that's one of your first steps.
Thank you.
So is there any questions for Toke and the crew? Okay, so it's about five of. Anything else of any topics before we sort of tee up the public input portion of the meeting today? Okay. So I think the staff will be reaching out to you to identify an additional date or two in March that we can squeeze in there to finish the refinement of the recommendations. Certainly, I encourage your subgroups to keep working, keep reaching out to the staff and all that for data needs. We've, you know, certainly identified some here today that you all need. And keep collaborating across panels. And you know, obviously the staff group, you know, will be supporting you as we go. So, and we'll keep populating the SharePoint with information that you need, and we're working on the templates and moving forward to get our recommendations in good shape. So again, thank you all for your good work and good ideas. And I think at this point we'll turn it over to the CADMIS folks, Jesse and Jay, to talk a little bit about the format of how we're going to handle the public input session.
Great. Thanks, Martin. And if Molly would be able to share your screen. Perfect. We're transitioning to the public comments portion of this meeting. We certainly appreciate public input on these recommendations, and we did send out there was a form that was circulated that allowed folks to sign up ahead of time to provide public comments. And the way that we'll be handling this is that first of all, each commenter will have 2 minutes to provide input. We'll go through all those who pre-registered to speak first. If you did not pre-register and you would like to provide comments today, if we have time, we can get to you. And the way that you sign up is you can use the Q&A function within this meeting. So that's on the bottom right of your screen. There's three dots on the very bottom right. If you press that, it'll bring up a button. You can click Q&A. And we would just ask that you submit your full name as it is showing up in this meeting, and any affiliated organization that you're here representing. It's fine if you're not representing an organization. You can just put citizen or whatever you'd like. And then, so we'll be indicating who is set to speak and who's on deck. So just, we'd ask you to prepare yourself, and when it's your turn to speak, you'll be upgraded to a panelist, and you should be able to unmute yourself, which you can do with this second graphic on the right here. So on the bottom of your screen, there should be several buttons in the bottom middle of your screen. The leftmost is your mute button. And additionally, it is encouraged, although not required, that commenters turn on their video during their comments. And so that can be done with the button right next to the mute button. Basically clicking the button that just says start video. So we had several people sign up ahead of time. And like I said, if you'd like to additionally provide public comment and weren't able to sign up ahead of time, please submit your full name and any organizations you're representing in the Q&A. So our first commenter will be, I'll also say before I jump into this, I apologize if I pronounce anyone's names wrong. Feel free to pronounce your name correctly when you're unmuted.
And Jesse, before you jump in, so yep. Yes, again, I just want to amplify what Jesse said in the beginning. You know, we really appreciate, first of all of your interest in just attending. We've had quite a bit of, you know, good interest in attendance at these meetings so far. We welcome your comments, and certainly feel free to comment anything you've heard about. But also, if you think we're missing something, you know, let us know, or something we should be looking at, or if you think we need some additional information, you'll feel free to direct us in the right area for us to investigate. Now, this next slide here is really just a very general slide in some of the areas that we're talking about, just so you can look at something while people are talking. But we have 1 hour, and we're going to get as many people as we can, but we're going to try and respect everybody's time and all that, and schedules, and stop right at 4 o'clock. But so if you, for some reason, we can't get to you, we apologize for that in advance. But at the bottom of this screen, you'll see a web address there, email address, and we welcome you to send any comments if you didn't get a chance to make your comments, or you think of something as you're listening. We've received a number already, some really great recommendations, some very specific recommendations for policy and strategy that have been very helpful. So we thank you for that. So again, thanks for coming. Thanks for your interest. And all right, Jesse, we'll get going.
Great. Thanks, Martin. And we're just going in the order in which we receive names, both in the sign-up form and then today during this meeting. So first up, we have Lynn Bruning, and on deck, we have Mike Ewell.
Good afternoon, and thank you. This is Lynn Bruning. I'm a concerned citizen, Duanesburg in Schenectady County. One of my concerns is, and I know that today you've been addressing a great deal about methane, but with the solar and wind power plants, specifically with energy storage, developers are submitting decommissioning plans to rural municipal towns and planning boards, of which suggest that they may recycle, but it is not required. And in one instance in a town in rural New York, a developer said that he was dumping over 20,000 solar panels into the local landfill. And when you contact the local landfill, of course, they do not accept solar panels and say that they will never accept them. So I'm wondering how the Waste Advisory Panel can assist us in rural New York with addressing how all of these lithium iron batteries from storage facilities, as well as the panels, will be disposed of correctly and properly over the lifetime of these projects. And I will submit a written comment for you. Thank you.
Great, thanks. That's a great comment, and something we were actually, we've been talking about, not necessarily in the waste panel, but certainly at, you know, DC and other places as we go forward, that a good management policy for those solar panels that get decommissioned. So thank you for that.
Great, thanks, Lynn. Up next, we have Mike Buell, and on deck, we have Tara Vamos. So Mike, feel free to go ahead and unmute yourself. Yep.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm dialed in as well, so I do.
It looks like we may have lost audio for Mike.
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you, Mike.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead. All right, just turn my 2 minutes over then. So I'll talk fast because I only have 2 minutes. Mike Gabel with Energy Justice Network. One of the few things I want to address is trash incinerators. There's a lot of focus here on methane, but not on CO2. And I've done life cycle assessments on this. I've seen waste or data from EPA and others showing that incineration is worse than coal plants for the climate. It is worse than landfills in life cycle assessment as well. And it's important to have objective data on that. There's a lot of misinformation on that. And I would recommend something where there's a public process to review the assumptions that would go into a life cycle analysis on this and have an independent subgroup, not some of the folks that are tied to the industry on this committee, but others to look at that and decide whether biogenic carving should count, whether offsets should be happening, a number of assumptions that make it look like they're a climate solution when they're not, because I think it's imperative that we have a policy to move the state away from trash incineration. Similarly, on sewage sludge, it came up earlier. New York is the top state in sewage sludge incinerators as well. It's about to be tied for number one trash incinerators, in which Florida closes one too. And there are a lot of greenhouse gases from incinerating sludge also, and it's best to digest and monofill that, not land apply it, as someone was speaking about earlier. Cornell University has documented a lot on the hazards with this extensively over the years, so I strongly recommend not seeing that go to the land. And finally, on landfill management, supporting organics diversion is great, but we need to look more comprehensively at having material recovery and biological treatment, like anaerobic digestion of sewage sludge and trash residuals before they're landfilled, as the best, lowest carbon way to manage the waste system. This has been documented in a report by EcoCycle on what to do with the leftovers on the path to zero waste. And there's also a lot you can learn from the zero waste hierarchy, which I helped develop, that talks about on the back end how to manage a landfill to minimize gas formation and maximize collection. And contrary to popular wisdom, it's actually better to flare than burn for energy when landfills are mismanaged for that. So there's a lot of information I hope we can have a further dialogue about that is not as well known to make sure that some of these recommendations are in the right direction. Thank you.
Thanks. Great comments.
Great. And up next, we have Tara Vamos, followed by Sam Lair.
Hi there. My name's Tara Vamos. I'm here partially representing New Yorkers for Cool Refrigerant Management. I just wanted to let people on this panel know that there is no panel that is taking care of refrigerant management. It's estimated to be 5% of 100-year GWP of New York State's emissions. And if we took 20-year numbers, which we're supposed to be doing according to CLCPA, it would be much greater than that. I know that this panel has brought up looking at extended producer responsibility in terms of appliance management for taking refrigerants out of appliances that are being thrown out. That would be fantastic. I urge you to extend that and look at all refrigerants as being something that could be managed using extended producer responsibility agreements, so that the canisters of gas themselves were something that people would have to pay a fee up front for, to help incentivize collecting them on the other side. I know the DEC has put together some regulations to bring us into accord with Kigali Amendment, but that is not going nearly as far as we need to go in order to meet New York's climate targets. And I hope that you will consider embracing refrigerants as your new pet project, and paying further attention to it. And then just in general, as far as all of the panels, I hope that you all look at reduction as a primary method, because it is the fastest and easiest thing. So don't ignore it, because it's simple. Thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
All right. So up next, we have Sam Ware, and that will be followed by Marco J. Castaldi.
Thanks, Jesse. Good afternoon. I'm Sam Ware, policy manager with the RNG Coalition. Thanks for the opportunity to comment today and to the panel for your ongoing discussion of RNG as an important strategy for the waste and energy sectors, along with other strategies such as source reduction and composting. Anaerobic digestion will be a necessary tool for dealing with the very large and growing amount of organic waste in New York. Producing RNG from organic waste and using it to displace conventional natural gas is a truly circular process. Utilizing this waste methane as an energy resource reduces greenhouse gas emissions, helps to incentivize better management of waste streams, both indirectly and directly, by providing a revenue stream, and doesn't require extraction or the large-scale build-out of infrastructure. Organic waste contains carbon, which is part of the near-term carbon cycle, meaning that all CO2 emissions from RNG are carbon neutral or biogenic. And this is a well-studied concept substantiated by, for example, greenhouse gas accounting principles from the World Resources Institute, among many others. Furthermore, looking at the life cycle of RNG production and use, there's a massive climate benefit where facilities capture methane that was previously emitted directly into the atmosphere, often making the fuel carbon negative. In other words, more beneficial than carbon neutral. New York is the sixth largest natural gas consumer in the nation, and that won't change significantly by 2030 unless we use all tools in the toolbox. Promoting RNG does not stand in the way of other strategies for dealing with carbon emissions from these far-reaching sectors, such as electrification. It's clear that, even in the long run, some applications, for example, certain high-heat processes, are simply not suited to run on electricity, necessitating the need for renewable fuels. Furthermore, incentivizing the use of RNG wherever natural gas consumption currently exists is a faster path to carbon reduction than electrification alone. A key principle of RNG is that it can be shifted to whichever end use most needs it. Therefore, it can ultimately be directed to its most suitable application as determined over time. But right now is the time to act in further developing this technology, because it will be necessary in the long term. It's well proven and currently available at commercial scale, and it's underutilized currently from New York's waste streams. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Great. So next up, we have Marco J. Castaldi, followed by Joanna Altman-Smith.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, coming through loud and clear. Yep.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, great, thanks. I want to thank you for allowing me to comment. Again, my name is Marco Castaldi. I'm a professor of chemical engineering at City University of New York, City College campus. I'm a technical fellow of the American Institute of Chemical Engineers and the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, and I've been doing research in sustainable waste management for about 17 years. I recently joined a biomass working group led by Johannes Lehmann at Cornell, which includes a number of things, also trying to understand the CLCPA that's being implemented. It's possible to reduce the impacts on the environment, especially greenhouse gas emissions, through more sustainable waste management. Yet we need to track those emissions and benefits in real time. I think there are some inconsistencies in the biogenic carbon accounting, the greenhouse gas inventory approach necessary to track the performance against the CLCPA targets seems only constrained to in-state sources. and therefore perhaps a, you know, net emissions approach, something like what IPCC uses for carbon accounting, might be needed to ensure that the policy decisions that are being made and going forward really capture all of the net emissions reductions. And to appropriately characterize those GHG impacts of waste management, perhaps the approach should include recognizing climate benefits of impacts of waste management that occur outside of New York State, and to treat all biogenic CO2 emissions the same as the US EPA recommends. Since waste and recycled materials move between states and countries, waste managed outside of New York could result in GHG emissions outside of the state's inventory. And I think DEC's path in how New York's existing gross inventory would be counted here is a little bit unclear. Yet a net emissions approach would include waste management emissions that occur outside the state. And lastly, just a good example of this is cardboard that's recycled in New York, which is great, reduces demand on forests across the world. Therefore, the emission benefits are really outside of New York, yet they're real and significant. So a net emissions approach that considers the benefits and might follow more closely the long-established waste hierarchy, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle, compost, AD, energy recovery, and finally landfill. So again, thank you for the opportunity to comment.
No, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Excuse me, Martin, before we continue, can you just take a moment, or and I guess I am, just to remind all of our commenters that if they would like to submit something in writing, if they want to submit a brief, maybe two-page statement that incorporates what they are presenting to us, which we take seriously and would like to review, the website at the bottom of the page, waste.climate.comments@dec.ny.gov. The panel is interested in reviewing your written comments if you want to send them along. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. No, well said. It's if people want to send along, like I said, if they had information, they have reports, they want to make sure that we're getting the right information, you know, feel free to use that email address. So thank you much.
All right. Up next, we have Joanna Altman-Smith, followed by Linda Leon. We can hear you.
Okay, great. Hi, my name is Joanna Altman-Smith. I'm a concerned citizen down in Brooklyn, New York. I'm really enthusiastic about your panel on a lot of different issues. I think it's got just so much potential for change, which is so exciting. I thought I'd throw out a couple ideas that you might not have considered so far to start. One is regarding pickup of household waste in high density areas, and considering policy or incentives to get municipalities to invest in on-street depots in the European style, whereby an entire block can bring their waste to one location. This will reduce emissions from starting and stopping waste vehicles proceeding slowly down a block, picking up individual loads, and it will also free up sidewalk access, which would encourage more walking, and that's in keeping with our emissions goals as well. Another idea that probably has something to do with the transportation panel as well is to encourage sanitation departments like ours down here in New York, very focused on cleaning roadways after snowstorms, not so interested in keeping sidewalks and corners and pedestrian ramps clear. So just get sanitation and other waste management companies who are in charge of snow clearance to focus on that, to increase mode shift to walking and riding bikes. Want to really support the whole concept of extended producer responsibility. I know there's a bill in the Senate right now. It's 1185, shifting recycling responsibility to the manufacturers who create packaging. Just a reminder that
something like 33% of world waste is packaging and paper products. So getting people to take care of that on the front end would have a big impact. Very interested in what we can do to electrify municipal and private waste fleets. Really concerned about air pollution, especially in frontline communities where the facilities are. And to that end, maybe looking towards not only electric vehicles, but also cargo bikes. World Bank had a good report a couple of years ago on how that's being used around the world. And we have a program here in Brooklyn called BK Rot that is all bike-powered organic waste pickup. Super successful.
And Linda, could you please wrap up your comments?
Yeah, it's Joanna. And no problem. I guess two last points. We miss our composting program here in Brooklyn. We lost our pilot program that did door-to-door organic waste pickup, and it's really changed people's habits to not have that convenience. No incineration, as per another speaker's comments. Even if we're giving it cute names, the co-pollutants are too great. And so far what I've heard about RNG leads me to think the same of biofuel. I think that it has too great a negative impact, even if the math comes out correct. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. We actually had BK Rods come in and present to us here recently. So, yeah, interesting local programs, as I mentioned before. So, thank you.
Great. And up now is Linda Leone, followed by Terry Weber.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Linda Leone, and I'm the Northeastern Vice President for Recycled Fiber Procurement at WestRock. I just wanted to take a couple minutes to share some information that WestRock is a manufacturer of sustainable fiber-based packaging with over 300 locations around the world. We operate one of North America's largest recycling networks, managing 8.5 million tons of recovered fiber each year, and we've worked with many of the groups that are represented on the panel. In New York, we have 900 team members in family wage jobs across 8 facilities and invest nearly $1 billion into the state's economy each year through salary, taxes, and supplier spend. One of those facilities is our Solvay Recycled Paper Mill, which is one of the largest 100% recycled paper mills in the United States. Each year, that mill alone diverts about 900,000 tons of fiber from our area landfills. We're deeply concerned about the inclusion of paper and potential recommendations that this panel may make for an extended producer responsibility program. While EPR may be an appropriate program for certain hard to recycle materials with limited markets, it's not appropriate for paper products. Paper recycling is a tremendous success story. Even with the recent disruptions to certain recycling markets due to China National Sword, paper products remain a valuable and in-demand part of the recycling stream. In fact, in 2020, we saw a significant increase in both export and domestic markets demands for recovered fibers. We and others in our industry want to buy recycled fiber. We can't operate without it. There are strong markets for these materials, and our industry invests billions of dollars to continue to improve our capacity for recovered fiber. Including paper in an EPR program will only add cost to New York businesses, costs that will reduce the amount of money we have available to provide jobs and invest in our recovery and reuse efforts, while providing little to no environmental benefit.
But to conclude, Linda, could you please wrap up? Oh, sounds like you're about to.
I got there. To conclude, if this panel has noted that EPR programs should be designed to divert materials from landfills and not implement simply to raise as a mean to raise revenue. And if diversion's the goal, with regards to paper, we think focusing on educating the public would be time well spent, as opposed to forcing paper into a system that would distort an effective existing market. So I'll end with, we strongly oppose the inclusion of paper in an EPR recommendation. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Linda. Appreciate it.
All right. And before we go in for our next one, just a reminder for folks to please try to keep their comments to 2 minutes. So up now we have Terry Weber, followed by Jane Selden.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Weber on behalf of the American Forest and Paper Association. AFMPA serves to advance a sustainable U.S. pulp and paper manufacturing industry. In New York, the industry employs more than 27,000 individuals with an annual payroll of over $1.69 billion. AFMPA members have made major progress industry-wide to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which should be taken into consideration in developing a GHG reduction program. On average, approximately two-thirds of the energy used at AFMPA member pulp and paper mills is generated from carbon-neutral biomass. By 2018, purchased energy efficiency had improved 13.3% and GHG emissions reduced 23.2% from our 2005 baseline. Bioenergy from forest products manufacturing residuals provides enormous greenhouse gas reduction benefits, roughly equivalent to removing 35 million cars from the road. AFMPA member companies reusing recovered fiber resulted in avoided greenhouse gas emissions of more than 16.5 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent in 2019. The paper recycling rate has grown over the decades and remains consistently high, meeting or exceeding 63% since 2009. According to the US EPA, in 2018, more paper by weight was recovered for recycling from municipal solid waste streams than plastic, glass, steel, and aluminum combined. Robust industry investment and manufacturing capacity utilizing recovered fiber is an essential pillar of our industry's success versus these competing materials. Between 2019 and 2023, U.S. packaging and pulp producers committed to investing more than $4.1 billion in new manufacturing capacity specifically designed to use over 7 million additional tons of recovered paper per year. We have concerns about the potential for EPR to disrupt this success. We encourage the Waste Advisory Panel and the larger Climate Action Council to avoid measures that might interfere with our industry's success in voluntary greenhouse gas reduction and recycling, and we look forward to continuing our work with the state of New York. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
Great. Thank you, Terry. So up now we have Jane Selden, followed by Cecile Michaud.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the important work that you're engaged in. My name is Jane Selden, and I'm here representing 350 NYC, a grassroots environmental activist organization. 350 NYC recognizes the vital role reduction and recycling of organic and non-organic waste plays in confronting the climate crisis. One-third of our waste stream is composed of organic material. If it enters landfill, it produces methane, a greenhouse gas far more potent than CO2. If incinerated, it produces CO2, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxide, which not only contribute to the climate crisis, but poison the marginalized communities that live near them. Diversion from landfill is key. Therefore, we support the following policy recommendations recommended by some members of the panel. First, we need to centralize and mandate donations of excess food and other products and set up a centralized government program to coordinate these donations in order to replace the random system that exists now. Secondly, collection of organics from businesses and residences, including public housing and nursing homes, should be mandatory, with the goal of ending organics to landfill and incinerators by 2050. Locally scaled composting and recycling needs to be expanded in a geographically equitable way. This should include conversion of some local waste transfer stations to composting, sorting, and processing sites. And in order to reduce tailpipe emissions from diesel trucks, there needs to be a transition to 100% e-transport or bike transport at the local level and marine and train transport for longer distances. Finally, there have been some solutions proposed that are very concerning to us. These are those related to incineration and waste to energy. We consider these false solutions and unacceptable under the CLCPA. Thank you very much for considering my comments, and I look forward to seeing the continuation of this important process.
Thanks, Jane. Appreciate it.
All right. Up now, we have Cecile Michaud, and followed by Phil Voss.
Hello, this is Cecile. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity given today to provide comments on this panel. So I'm Cecile Michaud from Cascades, and we would like to comment specifically on the topic of greenhouse gas accounting, since this is absolutely fundamental for us. Cascades is a leader in the recovery of recyclable products, and Cascades manufactures green packaging products as well as tissue paper. A few years ago, Cascades made significant investments in Western New York with its state-of-the-art Greenpack mill. In the Niagara Falls area, Cascades owns and operates two paper mills producing more than 700,000 metric tons per year of carbon paper from 100% recycled fiber. It's also important to know that Cascades' business model is based on circular economy since the very beginning in 1964. And not only we recycle old papers, but when possible, we further increase our participation in the local circular economy. That's why in the Niagara Falls area, the Coventa waste-to-energy incinerators located in the neighborhood were of great interest for Cascades. Instead of producing our own energy from natural gas, which would have resulted in high greenhouse gas emissions, we made the decision to purchase the energy from Coventa, promoting landfill diversion and hoping for less GHG emissions due to the biomass fracture. But to our surprise, in terms of GHG emissions, there were no benefits in doing so, which to us doesn't really make sense. So, and you know, Cascades is very serious at reducing all scopes of greenhouse gas emissions, and it starts with a fair greenhouse gas accounting. Therefore, we believe it is crucial that greenhouse gas accounting methodologies in the waste management sector include proper biogenic carbon accounting, as well as benefits for landfill diversion through recycling. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Great. So up now is Phil Voss, followed by Sue Fassler.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay, that's great. My name is Phil Voss, and I'm here from Energy Vision. Energy Vision is a New York-based 501c3 national environmental organization focused on advancing the transition to clean and renewable sources of energy and fuel. Under the current interpretation of the CLCPA, greenhouse gas accounting towards the state's 40 by 30 and 85 by 50 goals will be done on a gross rather than a net basis and will not take into account the GHG avoidance or negative emission strategies. Energy Vision is concerned that gross emissions accounting will negatively impact New York's efforts to accurately measure progress toward and to achieve its emissions and climate goals. While we understand and fully support the goal of achieving real reductions in direct emissions, we strongly encourage the state to adopt globally accepted net carbon accounting methodologies, such as those used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which account for direct emissions, avoided emissions, and negative emissions. It is unclear why New York needs different metrics than those rigorously science-based and globally accepted criteria. New York has very real opportunities, both for significant avoided emissions and for negative emission strategies. For instance, starting next year, New York will require that food waste that cannot be recovered for human consumption be diverted away from landfills to alternative processing, such as composting or anaerobic digestion. However, under gross accounting, the landfill emissions thus avoided would not be recognized. 2020's NYSERDA commissioned deep decarbonization strategies in New York State, which analyzed the options available for reaching the CLCPA's ambitious goals, makes multiple references to reducing non-combustion emissions, including from landfills. The quickest way to reduce landfill emissions for the long term is to stop putting the materials that create the emissions in landfills. But under gross accounting, the value of action that echoes one of the state's own planning documents would not be measured. Diverting food waste from landfills also contributes to a net negative emissions strategy. via anaerobic digestion, food waste can be converted into energy as biogas or as renewable natural gas. According to California's Air Resources Board and Argonne National Laboratory, renewable natural gas made from food waste is net carbon negative on a life cycle basis. Deep decarbonization strategies labels negative emission strategies as a pillar of deep decarbonization and recognizes the potential role of renewable natural gas in maintaining a zero emissions grid. Yet under a gross accounting system, negative emission strategies will also go unrecognized towards the 40 by 30 and 85 by 50 goals. The CLCPA rightly emphasizes the achievement of real emissions reductions rather than accounting slightly. However, its proposed use of gross accounting methodology would fail to recognize perfectly legitimate emissions reductions. This seems self-defeating, and we call on the state to reconsider its approach. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Phil. Appreciate those comments.
All right. Up now is Sue Fassler, followed by Michael Helm.
Great. Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Yes. Go ahead.
Wonderful. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Sue Fassler, and I serve as the Sustainable Facilities Manager at SUNY ESF in Syracuse, New York. I was disheartened during the January 5th panel meeting when I heard the words, "Waste is reality," uttered to kick off a subgroup report. The CLCPA should seek to think differently, be bold, ruffle some feathers, but with empathy and an open mind, create a forum for deep dialogue and introspection, make us feel uncomfortable, and most importantly, open the door to the difficult conversations that must be had if we have any hope of escaping our current trajectory of doing things the way that they have always been done. It is my hope that this group will focus on source reduction, reuse, and other upper hierarchy solutions. It is also important to retain a focus on behind-the-scenes operational changes, such as purchasing and surplus property. And I was very encouraged to see some of those recommendations included in the initial subgroup recommendations. Finally, I think it would be very groundbreaking to emulate and update a 2009 EPA systems-based greenhouse gas inventory for the U.S., which showcased the fact that 42% of greenhouse gas emissions result from consumption of goods. And this subset of emissions is larger than those produced by local transport and building HVAC and lighting sectors combined. It would be powerful to see an updated data set created for New York State with this systems-based approach. It is possible and necessary to set aspirational, if not seemingly impossible, goals while still recognizing, living within, and planning for our current reality. So in closing, I agree with the assertion that a member of this council shared when they stated that this group should be deliberate in deciding what it proposes to incentivize versus what it proposes to regulate. So please use your platform to challenge our consumptive culture, which relies upon continual extraction and poorly designed single-use products, and help to lead us to a reimagined, more fulfilling, and just future. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Up now is Michael Helm, followed by Akshay Wagray.
Thank you for letting me speak today. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you. Members of New York's for Cool Refrigerant Management have been closely watching the Waste Advisory Panel meetings, and we greatly appreciate the expertise and experience all of you bring to reducing the greenhouse gas emissions of New York's waste stream. As the time for submitting proposals to the Climate Action Council approaches, we want to make sure you have thoroughly reviewed the great opportunity to capture greenhouse gases by proposing extended producer responsibility programs for appliances that hold refrigerants and for refrigerants themselves. According to the EPA's greenhouse gas equivalencies calculator, the emissions from just 5 pounds of the refrigerant R410A have the same greenhouse gas footprint as driving the average American car for 1 year. One can find that much R410A in just 5 typical window air conditioners. But in our state, the recycling rate for window air conditioners and other appliances is extremely low. A well-designed EPR scheme would significantly boost that recycling rate and quickly prevent lots of emissions. While those appliances occupy a rather small slice of all HFC emissions in our state, many more refrigerants would be captured for reclamation or destruction if incentives were paid to the people who work with refrigerants. EPA regulations say nobody is allowed to vent refrigerants, but it's widely known in the HVACR industry that there's little or no enforcement of these regulations. This means it is common for those regulations to be ignored, especially in sectors where the refrigerant charges are under 50 pounds. Financial incentives for capturing used refrigerants would change the way business is done, boost reclamation rates, and avoid many more emissions. These EPR programs would be cost-effective, and moreover, the impact of the programs would be easy to quantify. Having pointed out these opportunities, we encourage the panel to prominently recommend both of these EPR programs to the Climate Action Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thanks, Michael.
All right. So up now we have Akshay Wagray, followed by Vernon Benjamin.
Hey, Jesse. Akshay just sent a message saying that they would like to defer their comments, so we can move on to Vernon.
Okay. So up now is Vernon Benjamin, followed by Abby Messick. And I think there's a little bit of a delay there, so bear with us while we get Vernon Benjamin set up here. Vernon, it looks like you might be muted, so please unmute yourself. If you can't figure out how to do that, we can unmute you on our end as well. Jay, could you go ahead and unmute Vernon? Vernon, you're now unmuted. Feel free to speak.
Thank you. I'm glad you addressed the problem in finding models to replicate and champions to abroad during the climate justice part of the discussion. As a climate reality trained leader, I urge you to expand your search for such models beyond the state, as you discussed in the meeting, through the internet worldwide. I think you'll find there's a lot out there that can help you because the numbers that you have to achieve, especially if you follow a 20-year model, are pretty spectacular. So you do have to generate some great ideas. Good luck in it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Great. Thank you, Vernon. And before we have Abby speak, I will just note for everyone, Abby Messick is the last person we have on our list. If you expected to provide comments today, or have since decided that you want to provide comments today, it is not too late to submit your name into the Q&A, the Q&A feature of WebEx. So please feel free to do so while Abby Messick is providing their comments. So Abby, you are now up.
Hello there. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'm pretty much out of my league with you guys. I'm a simple town board member in the town of Chatham, and I am not representing the town of Chatham, but myself. And if any of the comments I make are erroneous, it's out of ignorance of what your guys' work has been up to this point. My concern is with the composting efforts, that after looking at the lack of corruption in the recyclable programs and how places like China have turned our recyclables down because of the amount of garbage mixed in, I'm wondering if there's been an effort for a robust educational process for municipalities to let their citizens know that it's how important it is not to corrupt their compostable items. And is there an effort to get dollars to counties to increase the amount of transfer stations that have the capability to accept compost? And then furthermore, an effort maybe to close the loop for residents and to just make people feel like it's all like one big circle,
if there's a place where residents could actually come back to an area where compostable items have been stored and get compost. Those are, you know, just a couple comments I had, and thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Thanks, Abby. Yeah, there's a number of programs that New York State has actually in terms of some of those issues you raised. We have a whole Recycle Right education program that you can find on our webpage. It talks about, you know, the contamination issue and the recyclables. And we certainly have some municipal grant programs. So if you shoot your name into that comment email address on the bottom, we could circle back to you and help you and the people in your town take advantage of those programs. Thanks for the comments.
And I also want to flag that we had a few folks who signed up to comment, but we have not seen their name in the meeting list. That includes Cheryl, Joe Montori, Joanna Fallard, Nancy Matt, and Anasha Cummings. If any of you are in the meeting under a different name, feel free to write in the Q&A. Otherwise, we encourage folks to submit additional comments. Even if you spoke today, submitting comments in writing can still be helpful at the email indicated on the slide on the screen, race.climate.comments@dec.ny.gov. And I'll turn it back to you, Martin.
Oh, okay. So you don't have anybody else lined up? Okay. Well, we have a couple of minutes here to do wrap up, but thank you, everyone, for... who made comments, a number of very good suggestions, a number of which we're already working on. I was not responding necessarily to everyone just for interest of time, but certainly we're looking into to a number of the EPR programs, as many people said. We're looking into local scale waste handling. We're looking at a number of the programs to encourage composting and all that with a recognition of the waste hierarchy that's established in the New York State Solid Waste Management Plan. There was a number of questions about greenhouse gas inventories and counting and applicability of certain biogenic waste and how they're going to be counted and measured. We've certainly heard some of those comments before, and it's something obviously that the Climate Action Council is working on as we go forward. You know, obviously our priority still is the reduction of greenhouse gases and methane emissions. If we can find beneficial use for those methane and GHGs that are emitted, that's a side goal as well. So appreciate all the comments on that. Some of those are a little outside the purview of the waste panel, but certainly we'll capture all of these comments and pass them on if there's applicability across other panels. There was a couple about refrigerants. We do have that addressed in some of our very specific EPR programs, but certainly we'll take a look at whether there's an expansion that could be done there to capture the whole refrigerant waste stream. A couple people mentioned food donations, and we got a lot of recommendations underway there. So I don't know if the panels have any ideas or any comments about what they heard today. We can talk about it right now. And Jesse, of course, in the next couple minutes, if somebody signs on and wants to make a comment, we'll take a last minute comment or two as well. So anything, any comments here from the panel members?
So Martin, can I just add something?
Sure.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for sharing your comments and spending your time with us today. I really do hope that you submit something in writing as well to make sure that we all have your written comments in your own words. Specifically to the refrigerant folks, really, I appreciate you, your participation here. So I'm responsible for the planning unit in Onondaga County for comprehensive solid waste. We went out to bid for refrigerant management. We have a program, and I'm only getting one company that responds, so we're very happy that they responded, but I'm very interested if you could potentially also add to your comments the workforce development aspect and the economic opportunity for other firms or companies to be able to grow in refrigerant management. So that that's also something very disconcerting in upstate New York that I only had access to one responsive bidder. So if there's some barriers that you're seeing also from that workforce development and from just operating, that would be really helpful too. So thank you.
Well, I think there are two. I was writing notes down. The one person was talking about refrigerants, but also sort of made allusion to the sort of the best practices for people that are working with refrigerants. So I assume they were talking about people that are installers, decommissioners, those kind of things. So that was an interesting point as well, not just the refrigerants that are left in an appliance or left in a container, but all those that are lost during operation maintenance and all those type of things too. So
I do want to let you know the regulations are being followed, as I had to replace my 20-year-old air conditioner this year because of that issue. And they took that very seriously.
Yeah.
So that was helpful at least in the residential area.
Okay. Any other comments from the panel? Okay, Jesse, one last check with you and Jay, if there's anyone that is still listening that wanted to make a comment. We have a couple minutes left.
We have not received any additional requests at this point.
Okay. Yep, same here.
All right, well, if there's no other comments from the panel, again, you know, our next meeting is the 22nd. We'll send an agenda on that. It's going to focus on equity considerations. Please continue to work on your subgroups and your recommendations. Please reach out to the staff group as we help you refine those things moving forward that you're working on. And again, thanks to all the attendees that listened in. We appreciate your interest. We're making good progress. And thanks again to the panelists for all your time and effort. Last chance before I gavel it down, and we can seat back 10 minutes to your busy lives here.
Thank you, DEC.
All right, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
He said he has an opening. He could come to us. Bye.